Thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Sprocket Podcast.
Every now and again, our friend David Hetty stops into the show to guest host, and this time around, he introduced me to his friend Ian Moore from Waco, Texas. Over the phone, of course. Ian was in Texas, and David Hetty was here. Anyhow, we had a fascinating discussion about bicycling, both in Portland and in Texas, and we would like to share that with you here.
Hello?
Hey there, is this Ian?
Yes, it is.
Hey, excellent. This is Brock Dittus. I'm David Hetty's friend, and thanks for talking with us, man. Can you hear me okay?
No worries. Yeah, I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Excellent. Yeah, you're coming through loud and clear and sounding stellar. So,
hi, Ian.
Cool. Well, hey, here we are. I was actually trying to remember as I was walking home what we were going to talk about today. So, do you remember, David, what we were planning on talking about with Ian?
Couple things.
Okay.
Well, Ian, as I told you, came here for a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
And, I thought it'd be interesting actually, I think you brought it up, Brock, after I was telling you about his thoughts of how fast the commuters are here.
Oh, right, and, right. Okay,
was kind of one of the talking points, is just
totally
the difference in commuters.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
Another thing, when I was returning those pedals over to Ira Ryan, the guy who made Ian's wife's frame,
uh-huh.
Ira was saying how nice it was to actually ride with people that were nice on the road. Like, you know, saying when there's a car back and actually getting over in the lane. So,
right. Playing nice with traffic.
Yeah, playing nice with traffic. That was another thing. And then I think Ian... Jump in here, Ian, if I'm characterizing you wrong, but bridges the gap pretty well of like just he's got a history of biking in many different forms. So commuting and racing and whatever advocacy. And he's, you know, pretty deeply involved in Waco trying to get bikes and, you know, improved access for bike lanes and shit like that. So
would you say that's an adequate characterization, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much spend every waking moment either involved in some form of cycling, whether it's, you know, working with the bike club through the bike club on. Currently, our big push is advocacy in Waco because it's kind of lacking.
Okay.
So working, you know, through that or, you know, working, we have a city park here that is open to everybody, mountain bikes, hikers, whoever, it doesn't really matter as long as you're not using a motor. Working with the bike club in there, coordinating with the city on the trail building and maintenance and events that go on out there, or you know, working with the bike club on organizing their group rides or attending all the group rides and doing races and kind of everything that goes on. So
nice.
Yeah, we kind of coordinate a lot through the store here and a lot with the bike club in the community.
Yeah, so you're kind of the man about town. Do you want to introduce yourself for the wider audience, who you are and what your shop is?
Sure. My name is Ian Moore, and I own Bicycles Outback in Waco, Texas.
Is it Waco
kind of
or Waco?
Here.
I forget.
It's Waco, but we are kind of Waco, but yeah, it's Waco.
Is that the oldest joke in the book?
Yeah, I'm from Waco, too, so anyways.
Well, we kind of helped promote it by doing the Keep Waco Waco shirts for a long time, but... Yeah, we're 100 miles south of Dallas, 100 miles north of Austin, so we're right smack in the middle of Texas. Waco obviously has an interesting history, but it's actually an incredible town. It's great fun living here, and the riding here is actually really, really remarkable. So people drive through town and just see 35. They don't see everything else that's kind of on the outskirts. And any direction you go, you have a variety of terrain and a variety of riding and tons of great country roads, tons of gravel roads, incredible mountain biking right in the middle of the city. So lots to offer for the cyclist.
Excellent.
Hey, another interesting point, Ian, bringing up mountain biking in the city was I was trying to explain to Ian that we have zero access to single track in the city.
Yeah, here
I mean,
in Portland.
Little things, but
I was
Forest
I was
Park.
I was flabbergasted by that.
Yeah. So that's been a huge issue here, as I was mentioning to you, Ian, and it's an interesting dichotomy. You've got Portland, Oregon, and Waco, Texas. Waco, Texas having, you know, how many miles of trails do you have in Cameron Park?
We just finished mapping it, and there's right between 25 and 30.
25 and 30 miles.
That's miles of off-road paths for single-track mountain biking.
That is single-track in the city park, which is right in downtown.
That's pretty impressive, and that's the sort of thing that, yeah, you would expect, I suppose, here in Portland, Oregon, where there are mountains and trees and lots of plaid, that it would be the sort of thing that the city would be really excited about. But while there are a few projects in development, there really isn't anything official on the books in town right now. So, yeah.
Which, to me, was amazing. Originally, I came from California, where access is also a large issue. Originally in Southern California, where access is less of an issue. And then Northern California, Santa Cruz area, where access is always kind of a huge issue, whether it's state park land or university land or private land, there's always some sort of, kind of battle going on between cyclists and land managers or Sierra Club or whoever else. And then moving here to Waco, it's remarkable because there are no battles. I mean, there's a city park that's 400 and something acres in the middle of town. And we've signed some agreements with some adjacent private landowners who have opened their land for trails in exchange for cleaning out trash and doing stuff like that. And it's just remarkable. It functions pretty much seamlessly. I mean, there's, a tree falls, trails are messed up, the city calls the bike club or puts the word out to the bike club goes out and takes care of the issue and trails back open again.
Without a lot of complaint, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, hardly any complaints, no snags, no hiccups. The trails are well-maintained. They're all marked. They're all mapped. And it's all because the city and the club work really, really closely together to maintain the trails and to monitor the trails and make sure that they're progressing and that they're sustainable and everything else. And, so coming from areas where there are access issues to something like this, it's remarkable. And it's amazing, like you just said, that it's here in, Waco, Texas, of all places. It's actually a model that could work a lot of other places. But because it's Waco, it's kind of, it's discounted because it's Waco, not Portland.
Sure.
But, going out, it always amazes me the issues that people have with land access. And when Dave was talking about that, it's just insane. Since Portland is such a hub of cycling in the United States, and to not have that section of cycling available to, residents without driving is even more amazing to me.
Right, yeah. And there's a lot of places around town, like outside of town. If you have access to a car, you can throw your bike on a car. You can go out and ride that around. But if you do want to do that without having to drive somewhere, it is kind of interesting. You wanted to touch on Ian's background, right?
Yeah, I was just going to ask Ian for a brief background of your kind of cycling history, if whatever.
Well, my dad got us into cycling at a really young age, and he would take us on these insanely long road rides, which were, in third, fourth grade, we were going out and doing 25, 30 mile. And he also told us if we were going to be riding, we had to maintain our bikes. So he bought us a bike stand, he bought us some tools and set it up in the backyard.
Wow.
And so then my brother and I spent the better part of the next, 5 to 8 years tearing apart our bikes and my mom's bike, trying to figure out how to make them work. And there was a little bike shop in the town I grew up in. We'd always be down there and we'd always be in the back hanging out. And when we were of legal age, we both started working there. So I started at Bud's Bike Shop in Claremont, California, when I turned 15. So started there as a mechanic and kind of stayed on. And when I left high school, worked at Santa Ana Tandems for a little bit and then moved up to Santa Cruz where my brother was attending UCSC. And from there started working at Bontrager, doing in the frame shop, attended UBI and learned how to build frames and then worked in the frame shop at Bontrager, kind of as a gopher sort of, just kind of doing whatever needed to be done that day. So all over, did some powder coating and all sorts of other stuff. And then did some of their race stuff, as a mechanic for, some of their individually sponsored athletes. And then in 96, we founded a pro women's mountain bike team. And so went on the road as a mechanic for that team. And from there transitioned afterwards to, Team Ritchie and spent 4 years working with Team Ritchie and doing their World Cup team. So it's Thomas Frischknecht and a bunch of other people. And when they transitioned into Swiss Power, I transitioned to RLX Polosport. I was there for 2 years and then Subaru Gary Fisher. And in the meantime, had two kids. So ended up coming back here to Waco and working at the shop and then purchasing the shop. So been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
22 years now involved in the industry.
That's an impressive history.
All I do. So it is. I ride constantly, and I ride every morning and try to ride in the evenings and, you know, get kids out there. My wife races constantly. So, yeah, it's kind of, if, you know, if I don't have bikes, then I'm definitely grumpy. So.
I can attest to that. Yep. I'd also point out to your resume, well, I'm not going to say that, but if Hannah gets upset at me ever for going out for a bike ride, I just say, talk to Ian. He's the one that kind of got me into it. So you're
it's
also
Ian's
a
fault.
Scapegoat for for a lot of arguments. It's Ian's fault.
It's healthier than lots of other habits you could develop in this life. So
that is very true.
Great point.
Yes, we have a customer who always points out to his wife that it's better for him than beer.
There you go.
It makes him act nicer. So,
nice. Yeah. I have a hard time imagining bicycling as a substitute for beer, but I guess, yeah, I do like both of them. But yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the commuters in PT in Portland. You were just here a couple of weeks ago to visit, and you thought the commuting scene was interesting.
Oh, they were crazy. I don't think I've ever seen commuters ride so fast in my life. I mean, like, we would leave to go on rides from Dave's house or riding across town to get somewhere, and it's like they were racing. I mean, they were going, they were so hardcore, their heads are down, and they're just going. And, I mean, I was absolutely amazed by it, because, you know, I've commuted in Santa Cruz, commuted here, and, you know, everybody's pretty mellow. You know, and even in Santa Cruz, people just kind of, you know, stroll along. And out there, I mean, there are people riding, you know, carbon bikes and commuting. And it just seemed to, you know, it was funny to me, because they were so hardcore about it. And maybe it's the rain, trying to get out of the rain fast. I don't have any idea. But I was absolutely, even my wife was just amazed by it.
Like, yeah, funny when we were on our road bikes and people were just blowing by us, you know.
Right.
I mean, they were on road bikes too, but I mean, we were decked out going out for a ride and people were just blowing by us with backpacks on. And,
sure.
Yeah.
A new form of racing. So,
yeah, definitely. Well,
it's really interesting.
It's very interesting. I feel like I have a little bit of that myself. Like when I ride, I'm not a fast rider at all. I usually take it pretty slow. But there's a certain sense of competition that seems to be almost imbued in the commuting culture of Portland. Like when you're riding from one place of town to another and someone passes you. I mean, it depends highly on what your internal monologue is, or maybe dialogue, depending on who you are. But figuring out like what it is that says to you as you're riding your bike. And usually to me, I'm not a super competitive person, but it says like, well, you're not doing a good enough job bicycling on the roadways. So it's interesting. It seems like maybe there are a lot of mental games happening with the commuting scene here in town. What do you think, David?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think there's also a lot of people that race their bike. Well, but that's not, I think it's just the culture.
Uh-huh.
People trying to get fast. Maybe it's the rain a little bit, but
yeah.
I think it's just the culture. You get a few people riding fast and everybody rides fast. And, but there's kind of a push for, you know, slowing down. You've got, you know, Clever Cycles. I took you in there, Ian, that place selling, you know, the, yeah, big heavy ass Dutch bikes.
Well,
so
yeah. I mean, like when I commute, I get on my cruiser and I love it because it's like the time that I can slow down, you know, and I can like leave along the road or do whatever I want to do. So, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just, you know, because I do a bunch of group rides and race and stuff like that, you know, that my commuting time is my time just to kind of chill and like smell the flowers and look around. Or maybe for some commuters there, that's the time that they get to ride. So that's like that's their own personal group ride. It's their, you know, 40 minutes or whatever it is to work, you know, and setting their PRs on Strava or whatever they, however if they record their commutes or, you know,
their
wherever
Strava.
On. So,
checking out
Strava
the power meters.
Commute every day. So, you know, I mean, that would be
that's
kind
a good
of funny
point.
To look up, see if there are commute routes in Strava there in town and, you know, but,
I bet there are.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just it's kind of an interesting culture. I was really impressed with it, though. I was impressed with the amount of kids riding their bikes to school, too. That was great to see, because you don't see that very often. You don't see it here, because Waco is really not set up yet for commuting or for getting from point A to point B in town. And so it's great to see kids riding to school. I would love my kids to ride to school, but there's no safe way currently for them to ride from our house to their school. You know, so we, you know, preach bikes, we go to all the bike meetings, we go to all the advocacy meetings, yet we as a family have very limited, you know, ability to go ride from, you know, from home to school or from home to the grocery store just because the town is not set up for it. So
yeah, it seems like that. It seems like that's what is happening mostly across America, is that there's a lot of people that are really interested, but the facilities or the infrastructure don't yet exist.
Right, and I think a lot of that gets back to budgets. And, you know, they look at the budget of it and say, okay, well, it's going to cost us, you know. I think in the most recent issue of Mountain Flyer, there's an article on advocacy and how to set up your city for, you know, bikes and bike friendly. And so they were talking to, I think it's the mayor of Gunnison or somewhere, who just striped like the whole city. And obviously Gunnison is a fairly small place. So, but you know, she was saying that it's, you know, $15,000 or something to maintain their bike lanes every year. And so obviously you take that on a larger scale and it adds up. And then people are like, well, I only see 6 cyclists using that bike lane over the course of a week. So why am I spending, you know, $16,000 on those 6 people? Well,
yeah.
The point is those 6 people then, you know, go talk to their other people and say, tell them that, oh, I ride my bike here and it was great because I had this bike lane and, you know, the bike boxes or the shows or whatever else you have. And then, you know, then they get one more person and then it slowly grows. And eventually you can probably have more people, you know, but it is the initial jump that, you know, cities are kind of worried about making because they don't necessarily have extra budget to spend right now. And so going out on land and spending the money on setting it up for cyclists when it could take, you know, 5 years for it to become, you know, an everyday occurrence of seeing 10, 15 cyclists at once riding down the street. So.
Yeah, I think Mia Burke described it as like it's the catch-22, the classic problem of people don't bike because there aren't bike lanes, but there are no bike lanes because people don't bike, and trying to figure out how to you know, just reconcile that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to cast vision, I think, just for urban planning sometimes when it comes to active transportation. We're getting better at it, and it's getting easier and easier as time goes on, but those are new ideas for a lot of people.
Right, and it's, you know, it's one of those things where you have, you know, you have people who have been, you know, doing the urban planning in certain cities for maybe decades, and then, like, right now in Waco, we have, you know, there's the same city traffic engineer has been here for, I think, 25 years, and just recently we got a new metropolitan planning and transportation coordinator in town who is young. He's come from a couple of various towns that have a lot of cycling infrastructure, and so he is really pushing right now for cycling infrastructure in town. And so I think just catching it at the right moment and having the right people behind it makes a really big difference. And being able to quickly organize and quickly advocate for what you need is the way, you know, I think it's just kind of like catching it just right at the right moment so that you can carry that wave to the, you know, to the completion and make it work. And a lot of times those chances are missed because people don't have the advocacy group set up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it gets back to the whole catch-22 thing. And, you know, we are lucky because we do have a really strong club here. Both the bike club is really strong and the tri club is really strong. Even though we don't have the largest cycling population compared to like Austin or somewhere else like that, we have a very active population, which makes a very big difference. Because they're willing to volunteer their hours, they're willing to spend their time working on cycling for the good of the, you know, few hundred people here who ride.
And it sounds like very visible too.
Right. So, I mean, they spend a lot of time out in the community doing stuff, and I think that makes a big difference. So whether it's the mountain bike advocacy or whatever else, I think that where a lot of bigger towns, and maybe that's what Portland may actually be missing, is like a centralized kind of, you know, the Portland Bike Club or something that advocates for trails or advocates for the ability to get in the park there, Forest Park, for mountain biking. So
Yeah, I think it's the Friends of Forest Park that have been the other voice. Is that right? Do you remember?
That sounds right, yeah. I haven't followed the story very closely, so I'm not exactly sure. But yeah, that sounds
they have advocated quite strongly, but there's been some other strong voices. And they've put a bunch of money into studies. You know, they talk a lot about the environmental impact of trails and Forest Park and wanting to preserve it and what's the impact going to be. So they keep putting money towards studies, mm-hmm. which is frustrating to a lot of people.
Right. Well, and there's also kind of the unfortunate history in Forest Park of a lot of kind of rogue trail building where mm-hmm. people are just going in and saying, hey, it's the woods. I'm going to go and make my own path. And,
Make some sweet jumps or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And the jumps are admittedly sweet, but it's the sort mm-hmm. of thing that, if you don't go through the proper channels, that can really kind of delay the process farther down the road. So it seems like that's probably part of it too.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about playing nice in traffic. I was just going to you had brought that up, David. What were you thinking of with that?
Oh, yeah. I think it gets back to the, you know, fast commuters and whatnot, and how to deal with the tension of cars and bikes sharing the road. And I don't know, just like I was saying, Ira Ryan, a local frame builder here in Portland, had pointed out. Ian and Catherine are actually here picking up an Ira Ryan bike that he had built for Catherine. So we went out on a ride with him, and he was kind of amazed that people actually respected the cars on the road and tried to really share the road with them and do the right thing. So I don't know. Yeah, that's just kind of a part of what you guys do there, Ian.
I think part of it gets back to the fact that we don't have a ton of cyclists here. So when we are out on group rides and stuff, the club really advocates people riding safely and riding correctly in order to show that cyclists can be respectful and that cyclists do fit in the road. So, you know, when we're on group rides here or anything like that, there's always everybody, you know, makes sure to know that, you know, people say car back and, you know, people do scoot over. And so I think that it's just kind of ingrained in everybody here who rides typically that, you do share the road because you're trying to make a favorable impression on the motorist. Mm-hmm. For every, cyclist who's out there, pissing off a car, it doesn't do any other cyclist any good.
Yeah.
And that's the whole mentality of, I'm entitled to this road. A car is still a car and it can do a lot of damage to a personal bike. So there's rarely a time when a bike is going to win over a car. So, making a favorable impression on motorists so that they're then they go out of their way to, maybe not squeeze you close on the shoulder and maybe they'll move over and go around you, or wait for a correct time to pass. And so that's something that, it's kind of like paying it forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's something that's missing in, as people get raised into road culture and cycling on the roads, I think that they miss that bit of education. And I grew up in LA. I grew up riding in LA, and people there don't give a crap about cars. I mean, group rides always break every traffic law known to man. They don't stop for anything. They never move over. They make cars wait. Santa Cruz, the group ride is pretty similar. So they blow through stop signs and do all kind of stuff.
Nobody does that in Portland.
No one at all. No. I can say that with certainty.
You get here, and once again, it's kind of, people make the effort to, spread the word that bikes can be, share the road responsibly with cars. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's just because there aren't as many of us. I don't know. But it's something that the club, they bring up at club meetings. Hey, when you're on a group ride, follow the rules of the road. Club meetings are once a month, and that's brought up.
One quick story.
Ian,
when you were here and we were in downtown and in the bike lane and there was a van, there was a guy in front of us on a bike in the bike lane, a dude on a fixie, and the van had, his tires were probably on the white line of the, separating the vehicular, the cars and the bikes.
Okay.
And the dude knocks on the window, the guy on the bike, and says, "You're putting our effing life at risk," but, just goes mm-hmm. off on this guy. And I look back at Ian and they were just amazed at what, the tension there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was crazy. I mean, just cause that's not going to make, the guy in the van, probably didn't intend to have his tires on the white line. He wasn't purposely endangering the three cyclists that were in the bike lane at the time.
Right.
You know, but that type of interaction with between the cyclist and the guy in the van, you know, down the road isn't going to help anybody, because the guy in the van then at some point in time is going to remember that, be all frustrated cyclist. So,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of, you have to remember that there, besides you, there's other users in the end of it, that there's another family or another person riding their bike down the street after you. And that's, those are the people you need to think about.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
It's kind of, it's interesting.
It's kind of like we leave a bit of a trail or a little bit of a legacy of where we ride. I was thinking when I was a kid, my family had the classic evangelical Christian fish on the back of their car, and they were always very careful about how they drove, because they wanted to, you know, they wanted to reflect well on that image as they were driving on the road. And I've always thought of that, not so much in a religious sense, but at least as an advocacy sense with bicycles, that like every time we are on a bicycle, it's almost as though we had like the Christian fish, except we don't. But something like that, you know, where we are representing a brand of something to a public that doesn't quite understand us. So the small things that we do make a big difference.
Yep.
Yeah, there's always that, you know, you need to be aware that, you know, like I said, you're not the only one on the road. So
right.
2 months down the road, that van's going to come across somebody else riding down the road, and whether it's a mom or a dad or a kid, you know, somebody else. And so the impression that you left on that person in the van is going to affect how they treat that cyclist.
That's why I go around and knock on doors and ask them to roll down their window and say, I love you so much. You're such a good person. Thank you for sharing the list.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
What about bridging the gap between different kinds of cyclists, Ian? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think that everybody who rides is, you know, I mean, you're on a bike. So I don't think it affects, you know, how you should perceive what somebody's doing. Whether you're a commuter or a mountain biker or, you know, you just putz around on your, you know, cross bike or anything. I mean, you're all doing something that has to do with two wheels. So, as long as you're on a bike, I don't really care. I think it's just incredible that you're on a bike, because it's, you know, it's the way everybody should be. Everybody should be riding bikes all the time.
I remember I worked for Ian for a few years. Well, you were my boss, I guess, but he didn't own the shop back then. But I remember when the old, you know, mongooses, full suspension mongooses from Walmart would come in, and although we appreciated the two wheels that they were, we would have fun with those.
Have fun with as in destroy, or
just a few cuss words, because they never quite, you know, get fixed.
There's only so much you can do.
There's only so much you can do. Anyways.
Go ahead, Ian.
Oh, no, that was about it.
Oh, okay, there we go. Yeah. So, yeah, just the idea then that, it's almost as like in a town where you have fewer infrastructure pieces and maybe more resistance to cycling, it's probably a lot easier to band together with anybody on two wheels. I feel like the culture of Portland has flourished to the point, and I mean, it's not perfect by any means, but we've flourished to the point where people feel comfortable on bikes, and we've been able to turn our attention at least part of the time away from maybe the other traffic culture and the other vehicles that were on the road. And then we get to start tearing each other apart for the way that we dress and the things that we wear. And I'm probably the biggest culprit. You and I know that, of course. You know, I make a lot of jokes about spandex. And
do you talk to me behind my back when I wear spandex?
Of course.
Thank
you. Of course
you.
I do. I'll
never say it to my face.
No, but when the biggest issues, maybe the biggest issues of safety and being able to be on the road and feel comfortable with it are out of the way, I guess that's when we can kind of start to be a little bit more snarky about the kinds of things that we wear. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I feel like there's a lot of that. And Bike Snob's all good and fun. You know, he's a fantastic rider, and I appreciate his riding immensely. But it's also like there's a certain amount of sarcasm in there. And I don't think I'm always as I'm not always as flip as maybe I could be about that. Like it's okay to be maybe to observe differences and say, oh, that's kind of funny. But I think I've been the kind of guy that will harbor a certain amount of resentment against another aesthetic, which when I say it that way, it just sounds dumb. So I think
I forgive you.
I'm working on changing. Thank you.
Ian, say you forgive him too. We all forgive you, but yeah, no, it's easy to do, especially like you're saying in Portland where there's such a diverse culture and
right.
Everybody's kind of, well, not jockeying for, it's just easy to do.
Right. Anyway. Well, you're jockeying for cool.
Yeah. And, jockeying for cool.
If you're able to define what it is that's cool and what's not, then you're able to advance yourself along those lines.
There
so,
you go.
Yeah. Are there any problems at all like that in Waco?
Very few.
Okay, that's good. It sounds like
we haven't gotten to that point yet where we're making fun of the 60 guys versus the normal riders.
There we go. Well, you know, I should probably go down there for some soul rehab someday.
You should. You know, we wave at other cyclists too.
There you go. That's
as you're riding by, you wave at the cyclist going the opposite direction. Where you know, in Portland, my wife and I waved at everybody, and we got very few waves back.
I remember you saying that. Yeah, that was discouraging.
Yeah, everywhere we go, we wave at everybody, and it's kind of funny to figure out where people will wave back. So
I've been waving since then.
Portland, we had a couple people wave back at us. So you guys are up on Southern California there.
That's good to know. Is there anything else you'd like to say about bicycling, simplifying your life, anything else at all?
No, I think we've covered most of it.
We have. We've covered a great deal of ground this morning. Well, thanks for chatting with us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Appreciate your time. I know you're busy.
All right.
Take care, man.
Talk to you guys later.
All right. Good luck out there.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Oh, that was fun.
He could talk for hours.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's fantastic.
22 years of bicycle industry.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Sprocket Podcast. You can find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send us feedback about the program. Send us your suggestions for anything you'd like us to talk about, anything you'd like us to drink, or anyone you'd like us to have on the show. Our email address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail at 503-847-9774. We can put it on the program for you. Or you can text message us at that same number, 503-847-9774. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music. He's on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. And thanks to Hurtbird for our headline sounder there at hurtbirdmusic.com. Keep listening, and we'll see you next time on the Sprocket Podcast.